The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. I'm Morris Williams, and I'm my privilege to welcome you on behalf of the Free Library of Philadelphia to what I think is going to be a most fascinating evening. First, a little housekeeping is in order. Please turn off your cell phones, no flash photography, and please join us upstairs after the question and answer for a book signing by the author. I do want to urge you to buy The Roaring Nineties by Joseph Stieglitz. It is a fascinating book about a variety of topics. First, it's a history book. And our speaker has worked with many interesting individuals, but just think of someone who worked with Bill Clinton and Alan Greenspan and Bob Rubin. That's an interesting trio, and you might want to ask him about his impressions. The second is that we probably had more change in the last 15 years with regard to our economy and our society. And one of the main topics of this book is about the appropriate role, the appropriate size of government in our society and in economics in particular. The third thing that I think is important about this book and the work that Dr. Stieglitz has done is in terms of a global economy. We all are part of this global, interactive world economy. He spent about 25% of his career working overseas, and of course many of his students were from overseas, and so he has a perspective that I think will be fascinating for us to benefit from. I think you have the general biographical information in terms of his growing up in Gary, Indiana. I had the privilege of chatting with him before I came out, and he indicated in terms of libraries of interest that the library in Gary, Indiana was very influential in terms of his own early education and interest. And he writes in this book that at age 14, he decided he wanted to be a college professor. What he didn't write in the book is that he's probably one of the very few people in the world who became a full professor at Yale University at age 26. Quite an accomplishment, probably exceeded only by the fact that he won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 2001. Now, I'm not an economist, and I couldn't quite explain the description of the work that he, for which he won the award as it's in your handout, but my understanding of the work that he did is that we don't have perfect markets, that in fact participants in the marketplace receive information at different points in time and with different impacts. And so there is, in his work, some question as to whether all markets are truly free and truly efficient. And you may want to explore that further with him. But he is currently professor at Columbia University, and the last observation I would make is that his role there is unique in another trend in American society, and that is the star system. And Dr. Stieglitz is a star in the world of economics and academia, so much to the extent that the New York Times wrote an article about his coming to Columbia to help Columbia rebuild their Department of Economics to a position of preeminence, because they felt that they had been surpassed by some other unnamed schools and they wanted to be number one again in the ranking polls. But our speaker therefore has a background of academia. He has a background of the heartland of America, because certainly change has occurred in Gary, Indiana. And he has a background in terms of having worked with some of the most interesting people in terms of shaping our global economy and its impact on the United States. Please join me in welcoming to the Free Library of Philadelphia, Dr. Joseph Stieglitz.
Thank you. Very good. Well, thank you very much for that introduction. I think you've said everything I wanted to say. Well, it's hard to remember in the current mood in the United States the kind of euphoria that was present in the 90s. But just to bring you back, there was a period of a stock market bubble. The economy was very strong. Unemployment was down to 3.8%. Most people thought there was what they called the new economy. And many people thought that the new economy would bring with it the end of the business cycle. Well, nobody talks about that anymore. We've had a recession from which we are just recovering. I'll say a few words about that later on. Another area of enormous euphoria was in the area of globalization. The advocates of globalization thought it was going to bring unprecedented prosperity to all the countries of the world, not just to the United States. And they, try to push it into new directions, capital market liberalization and a whole variety of other trade liberalization, the Uruguay Round, NAFTA. All that began to unravel much quicker than any of us had hoped. By the end of the, just after the end of the decade, beginning of the new millennium, the stock market bubble crashed. The economy entered a recession. Globalization became much, the attitudes towards globalization changed dramatically. Perhaps the most defining event was what was supposed to be the beginning of a new round of trade negotiations. Trade negotiations occur in these very intense periods where you discuss a whole variety of issues, and the round of trade negotiations is usually named after the city where it began, or after the president who was president when it began. So we have the Tokyo round, the Uruguay round, and the Kennedy round, and President Clinton wanted this to become known as the Seattle round, or even better, the Clinton round. But, of course, all we remember today is the Seattle riots. And what was very clear is that at least some people were not very happy with what was happening with globalization. Now, to many economists, this was a mystery. They said, really, the problem wasn't with economics, it's with psychiatry. Why are these people better off but don't know it? But, in fact, as economists looked at what has actually had happened, they recognized that things had not been going that well, that, for instance, the poorest region of the world, sub-Saharan Africa, was actually worse off by about 2% after the last round of trade negotiations, the Uruguay round that had ended in 1994. They recognized that, for instance, that when the trade ministers had signed the trade agreement for the Uruguay round in Marrakesh in March of 1995, they had condemned hundreds of thousands of people to death because the intellectual property provision of that agreement that was written basically by our drug companies and by our entertainment industry, not by our scientific community, had the effect of depriving these, the poorest people of the world, of access to life-saving drugs. The imbalance of that trade agreement of the Uruguay Round was so great that was illustrated by the fact that the North insisted that the South eliminate their tariffs and eliminate their subsidies, but the North did not fully reciprocate. And the result of this, just let me give you two examples that I think help illustrate the nature of this imbalance, and it'll feed into what I come back to a little later. Today, in the United States, we give $3 to $4 billion of subsidies to cotton. Goes to 25,000 per year. It goes to 25,000 fairly well off, very well off farmers. So, $3 to $4 billion is shared among these 25,000 farmers, but they only get the money if they produce more cotton. Well, the laws of economics, we don't intend to do any harm, but the laws of economics are very clear. If you produce more, which you have to do to get these subsidies, the price goes down. So as the price goes down, we lower the well-being of farmers in, for instance, sub-Saharan Africa who are dependent on it. So we force 10 million sub-Saharan cotton farmers into below subsistence. And the damage that we do is greater than our foreign aid. Our U.S. Trade Representative, who's the person who does the negotiations at Cancun, said to the African cotton countries who were complaining about this, well, you should find another line of business. Cotton grows in sub-Saharan Africa in mostly arid areas that have no alternative, whereas our cotton farmers do have an alternative. But just to make sure that you know that I'm not discriminating against the United States, EU is equally guilty. The average cow in Europe gets a $2 a day subsidy. That number sort of resonates in the development community because in World Bank definition of what it means to be in poverty is $2 a day. And some 2 billion people in the developing world live on less than $2 a day. So to put it another way, it's better to be a cow in Europe than to be a person in the developing world. Well, what I just wanted to bring out is how that euphoria that all of us felt a decade ago has changed. The mood has changed both about our economy and about globalization. And the purpose of my book in Roaring '90s was in a way to try not so much to talk about who was to blame for the failure, what went wrong, but also, even more, to try to learn the lessons so that we don't repeat them. And so what I'm going to do in the remaining time available is to try to talk about some of these lessons. I'm going to focus on both the what we call the microeconomics, the specific regulatory policies, the other policies, the macroeconomics, the overall performance of the economy, and globalization. Those are the three themes I'm going to have time to talk about. And let me first begin by putting the broad issue of the microeconomics into perspective. The most important result, probably the most important result in economics, is referred to as Adam Smith's invisible hand. The argument is that the market economy, the pursuit of self-interest, leads, as if by an invisible hand, to economic efficiency. Never said anything about social justice, but that it would lead to economic efficiency. Well, underlying that result were a number of assumptions, and my own work focused on one of the most important assumptions, the assumptions about information, that there's perfect information or good information. The work I got the Nobel Prize for was related to what we call it asymmetries of information. When you are an academic, you have to invent big words so that at least you sound like you know something. Asymmetry of information simply means that some people know something that some other people don't know, which, of course, has to be true, otherwise I couldn't be here. So the notion, what my own work showed was that when information is imperfect or asymmetric, which is always, the reason that the invisible hand often seems invisible is that it's not there. Or, to put it another way, and this is one of the major themes of the book, that the pursuit of self-interest, which is another name for the greed, pursuit of greed by the CEOs, by the head of the New York Stock Exchange, did not lead to economic efficiency, did not lead to the betterment of our economy. It did lead to the betterment of a few individuals, but a lot of other individuals suffered. And so the book, in a way, is trying to understand try to explain what went wrong in this, why it was, in very specific terms, why it was that this pursuit of self-interest or greed did not work in the way it was supposed to. In a way, the other theme that was emphasized earlier is that every game, football or any other game, needs rules and regulations. Referees. If you don't have that, a football game would be chaos. The market is just like that. You need rules, regulations, referees. And if you don't have that, you have chaos. And the problem was that in the 90s, as in some earlier periods, and as now, we didn't understand the right role of rules and regulations. We tried to deregulate too far. And the issue should not have been whether we had too much or too little regulation. The issue was really getting the right regulation. I'll give you some examples of where we should have done things that we didn't do. So the underlying this failure was a failure to understand the appropriate balance of the role of the state and the role of the market. The market is at the center of a successful economy. But you can't have the market working on its own. And if you don't have the right environment for the market to work, it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. Let me begin by giving you talking about one of the more important examples of this, and that has to do with the accounting of stock options. During the 90s, increasingly important, stock options became an increasingly important way of paying senior executives. And stock options are wonderful because the person getting the option knows that they're valuable. But no one knows where they're coming from. That is to say, one person is getting money, but who's giving it to him? Well, the basic law of conservation of matter says that if somebody's getting money, somebody has to be giving it to him. And the question was, who was that? And our accounting framework did not make clear what was going on. And the corporations did not want it to be the case. Well, it's very clear who is giving the CEOs the money, the senior executives the money, when they give a stock option. What you're doing is, if you used to own 100% of the company, if you give 20% of your stock, the value of the stock, to your CEO, you own only 80%. So you've diluted the value of your ownership. So the shareholders effectively were giving the money to the CEO and his and executives. But they didn't know it. And that was the wonderful thing about it from the CEO's perspective. So they could get as much money and no one was unhappy, because no one knew that they were giving it to them. Well, the Financial Accounting Standards Board said, this isn't good. We ought to have a better accounting system that makes it easier, at least, for people to know what was going on. And they proposed the appropriate accounting treatment so that you would report these stock options as an expense of the company. It's called expensing stock options. Okay, so they could see what was going on. That, in fact, you were spending 20% of the income of the company on CEO pay. Well, not surprisingly, a lot of the CEOs didn't like this idea. Wall Street didn't like it. Silicon Valley didn't like it because they used this extremely extensively. And we had in the Clinton administration a very heated debate on this issue. There was a debate throughout in lots of other aspects of Washington. Arthur Levitt, who was the head of the SEC, and the Council of Economic Advisers both thought this was a very important reform. The U.S. Treasury opposed it. The argument that they gave was very telling. They said that if we did this expensing, stock prices would come down. We thought that was an argument for the reform, because what it was saying is if people only knew how much you were giving the CEO, they would say the stock is worth less and the value would come down and it would be reflecting reality. But of course, they thought it was an argument against. Question is why? Well, the obvious answer is we were just about to have a big party, a stock market party, and no one wants to be a party pooper. especially when your friends are going to be make off like bandits in the party. So the Treasury and the Commerce were successful in putting pressure on the FASB not to have this reform. Arthur Levitt, who also gave in, as I say, was the head of the SEC, views it was the biggest mistake that he ever made as chairman of the SEC. And so we continued with this system. It was actually interesting, just as another side point, was that no one understood in the White House why the council, why I was so impassioned. Usually accounting is viewed as the only subject more boring than economics. And here, economists were getting, I was impassioned on the subject of accounting. And they thought this was really weird. The answer was very simple. The market is based on information. Prices give signal what to produce. A high price says something's valuable. A low price, it's not valuable. So a high price is a signal to produce more. Well, the price system only works if prices are based on information. They're made up, but they're based on bad information. The prices will be bad prices. They won't be accurate prices. They won't reflect reality. And the signal that they're giving to the economy about where to allocate resources will be wrong. And the result of that is you get misallocation of resources. And that's precisely what happened. And that's why we cared about the subject. So as a result of that, the stock prices got higher and higher, and I'll come back to some other factors contributing to it, and you got this bubble, when it got so high, it was inevitable that it would break, and when it would break, it would cause enormous distress. Now, let me make clear a couple points. First, no matter what the Clinton administration would have done, there would have been a boom and a bust. I mean, not inevitably, but very likely. That we've had these booms and busts since the beginning of capitalism, and they are often associated with a burst of technology, and we did have an internet burst of technology. So that in some sense, my criticism is not that there's nothing they could have done to actually eliminate the boom and the bust. But I do criticize them, both that and the Fed, Greenspan, for making the bubble much worse, and therefore making the crash much worse. They put froth on what was already a bubbly situation, and therefore they exacerbated what was already there. The second point is that it's not just the stock options. The stock option, it's not just the information that was contained, the distortion that was associated with stock options. The stock options had another problem. That is, the CEOs could make more money by giving distorted information than coming up with good projects. Because with a stock option, your pay depends on your stock price. And it's your stock price in the short run, not in 10 years, but your stock price in the short run. And what's the best way to getting your stock price up? Giving some bad information that everybody believes that your profits are going to be going up. An enormous amount of ingenuity was used to distort accounts to make it look like you were doing better than you really were. What this emphasizes is something economists have always emphasized: incentives matter. But if you have the wrong incentives, you get bad outcomes. And that was one of the things that went wrong. We had incentives that were misdirected. And then one other point I wanted to make, and I'll explicate this a little bit. Some people say, well, it's just a few bad apples. People like Ken Lay or, say, at Enron. But the fact is, as I'll comment in a minute, it involved a very large number of CEOs, every one of the major accounting firms, almost every one of the major investment banks. When you see something that is that pervasive, you have to conclude that it's systemic. It's not just an accident. It's not just that people that were born 30, 40 years ago, there was something in the water that made them less moral. It was that they had the wrong incentives and that they were induced to behave in ways that I think in the end we have to say was immoral. It was a kind of theft. but that the system provided them the wrong incentives that led to this bad behavior. So I described so far a little bit about the CEOs, but as I say, they were not alone. The accountants joined them. The accountants are supposed to give reliable information about what is happening to the firm, but they became co-conspirators. And the incentives, again, were very clear. It used to be, not that long ago, in the 80s or 70s, that accountants used to do things like accounting. But by the early 90s, accountants were making most of their money, by doing consulting. And they were hired by the CEO. So if the CEO is hiring you and giving you a huge bundle of money for consulting, are you going to be nitpicky about a little bit of accounting creativity? In fact, you're going to show how bright you are as a consultant by showing how you can creatively manage the accounts. And the game became very clear. It was a game that actually had started much earlier in the 70s, 80s, where the accountants got in the business of, viewed many circles as a legitimate business. How can I minimize the corporation's tax liability without going to jail? So they tried to design the accounts in such a way that the reported income was as low as possible, move as much of it offshore, do whatever you can to get your tax liability down. And that was viewed to be perfectly acceptable because you were only robbing everybody else in the country. You were robbing the public purse, but that wasn't taking anything away from any particular individual. But the breakthrough, the intellectual breakthrough that occurred in the early 90s, was that they said you can use these same techniques not only to reduce your tax payments to rob up the IRS, but you could do it to cheat your shareholders. And that was a major breakthrough, intellectual breakthrough. And then they did this with a great deal of, as I say, creativity. And again, the objective was very clear, to do as much misrepresentation as you could without going to jail. Now, some of them went a little too far and have wound up in trouble. But they were always trying, I want to make this clear, they were always trying to stay within the rules. And a few of them, you know, as they wound up going over the bounds, but that was not the intention. And then they were joined in a way by the banks. The problem with the banks were always present, and many of us were always a little bit mystified why there wasn't more bad behavior on the part of banks. They always had a potential conflict of interest. An example with the analysts. The analysts always work for two people at the same time. They always worked both for the customer, but also for the investment bank that they were trying to sell the shares for. And at the heart of conflicts of interest can be viewed as information problem. You don't really know whose interest you're representing. And one of the aspects of public policy is to try to reduce these conflicts of interest. So to go back a second, in the area of accounting, there was a very simple regulation that would have changed the conflict of interest that Arthur Levitt proposed. He said accountants should do accounting. Not a dramatic regulation, and not one which would require an extensive bureaucracy. But the accounting industry resisted it. They fought it tooth and nail until after all these problems came to light. Well, as I say, there are a whole set of issues of conflicts of interest in the banking. The point was that the analyst had an incentive to keep their employer, the investment banks, happy. And in the euphoria of the 90s, they decided that was more important than giving accurate representation of information to the shareholders. They could make more money that way and cash in, and you know, by the time the shareholders found out that they were selling dogs, they'd be out of business in comfortable retirement. And that's what happened with analyst after analyst in the market. There were other problems, for instance, that we had big debates about and unfortunately came out at the wrong side. One of the important pieces of legislation, I think, that in the United States was passed in the aftermath of one of our previous kinds of episodes like this, it's called the Glass-Steagall Act, that separated out investment banking from from commercial banking. The reason for this, potential conflicts of interest. And the Treasury, under pressure from the banking industry, which they were very involved in, wanted to eliminate this act, the Glass-Steagall Act. The Council of Economic Advisers again opposed it. We said, you know, there are going to be these problems arising from conflict of interest. The first answer of Treasury was, don't worry, trust us. And we said, well, we've seen that in the past. And although we trust you, we trust in economic incentives even more. And that if their incentives are wrong, behavior will be bad. So then they said, okay, we'll create Chinese walls that were supposed to be sufficiently high that no one could climb over. And then I said, well, the first point was, if you really create the Chinese wall so you don't interact, why put them together? The only reason to put them together is for them to interact. So if you create Chinese walls so they don't interact, then you've just undermined the reason for bringing them together. Well, they never liked that argument. They passed this repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, and even before, or even as it was getting repealed, you could start seeing them climbing over and under the Chinese walls. And it's often difficult to get the full scope of some of the problems. And one of the good things that's come out of some of the trials is that we've got, and the bankruptcies, is that we've gotten some more evidence about what is going on. And one of them is, like, in the WorldCom, one of the things it did is it some of the bankers of WorldCom knew that they had overextended exposure to the banks, to WorldCom, and that they understood the risk of WorldCom going bankrupt. So what did they do? The investment side said, okay, we'll start issuing bonds. We won't tell them how bad WorldCom is. And those bonds, they'll use that money so that they can pay down our loans. And they did that quite extensively. So that is an example of how the synergy of the banks, the accounting firms, the CEOs, the whole information system failed. And the result of this was, as I say, a bubble that finally broke. Let me spend, since the time is very limited, let me talk a little bit about the macroeconomic situation. As I said, there was this bubble, and the natural question when you have a bubble is, should the Fed have done anything about it? Could it have done anything about it? Was it obvious that something ought to have been done about it? Well, very interesting about this is in December of 1996, Alan Greenspan gave one of his most famous speeches where he talked about the market's irrational exuberance. He was worried about a stock market bubble. And one of the wonderful things about being chairman of the Fed is that you can actually move markets. So after the speech, the market did go down for about 3 days. 3 days later, new employment data came out, and people started being more confident about the strength of the economy, and the economy just went right on as if he had never given that speech. And if you look at the data now, you can't see that speech anymore. It just went straight on. And then the remarkable thing that happened is that rather than worrying about this bubble, he became a cheerleader. He started what we call a techno-optimism. He believed that there's new economy. The technology meant that there was no limit to our economy. And as he started talking up the bubble. Now, as an economist, I actually don't blame him too much for that because I don't think, as I say, that words matter that much. They have a little bit of effect. As I say, you can move the market for a few days, but I don't. I think he was only one of many people that were contributing to this excess optimism. But where I do blame him is that he had instruments at his control, at his disposal, that probably would have dampened the bubble. And in the minutes, one of the things is we have more transparency now than we used to in the Federal Reserve. We talk about transparency all the time in public life. Well, now the minutes of the Fed are released after 5 years. It doesn't give you exactly on-the-time information, but we can go back for people looking at historical. You can see what's going on. And we see that they actually discussed this. And I've talked to some other people on the board, and it was an issue. They knew that there was a bubble, and they knew they had an instrument, raising margin requirements, that would probably have worked. Raising margin requirements is like raising the down payment you have to pay on a house, raising the down payment you have to pay on the stock. And that just means you can pay less for the stock, and that would have probably dampened the price of stocks and dampened the bubble. Wouldn't have eliminated it, but would have made it less. But they chose not to do that. And why? We don't. The Minix doesn't say why they messed up. They didn't know it at the time. But we can only infer two things. One is they, too, didn't want to be a party pooper, just like the Treasury didn't want to be a party pooper. And the other one is that they have a commitment, an ideological frame, that makes them very averse into micromanaging the economy. Their view is you shouldn't intervene in things other than open market operations and rediscount rate. You shouldn't do in margin requirements. So I do blame the Fed for not doing what it could have done to rejuvenate the economy. Let me turn to the third theme very briefly, and that is globalization. As I said, globalization clearly turned out not to be what everybody had hoped. But I think the problem goes back earlier. With the end of the Cold War, there was an opportunity, I would say even a responsibility, to try to redefine the global economic order, in fact, to redefine all aspects of global policy, international policy. For four decades before the end of the Cold War had defined every aspect of international economic life. The enemy of our enemy was our friend. We could be friends with Pinochet, even as he was killing thousands of people, simply because he was anti-communist. We could give aid to Mobutu in Congo, knowing that that money was going to go into a Swiss bank account, not helping Congo at all, making that country more impoverished because it owed us money. But we weren't interested in development. We were interested in buying friendship. We didn't want them to become part of the Russian sphere. There are examples of examples of this. But with the end of the Cold War, at last we should have been able to say we want to begin to define our international policy based on certain principles and values. And in certain areas, we did that more than others. We did stand for more, we took a stronger stand on human rights, civil rights than we had before. But in the economic arena, we did not. We failed. We let a set of special interests dominate our policy. So we didn't have it determined by any view of what was right, what was fair. It was all, what could we do, what could we get for America? So when we went to the Uruguay round, we didn't say what was a fair global system. We said our farmers want certain things. They don't want to give up other things. Our banks want certain things. What can we do? And they went there surely, simply as a bargaining and getting the best deal. The whole focus was, you know, how can we create jobs in America? Not what we do to the standards of living of those abroad, not to the question of whether it was fair. And the consequence was this enormous backlash that was engendered by the end of the decades, because people saw that what we had done was not fair. It wasn't even actually very, it wasn't even very efficient in many ways. I mean, give you an example of just a very brief story. The Council of Economic Advisors at the beginning of the Clinton administration said, well, as we discuss international economic policy, we ought to think about what were a set of principles that should guide us. What were the things that were most important to America? What were the most important values? You would have thought that was an obvious thing. Well, this notion engendered enormous opposition. The U.S. Treasury said we should not have any priorities. Why? Well, the particular case in point that we were discussing at the time was Korea. And the United States is involved always in trying to open up markets around the world. And you have one of the fun things about being at the council, you wind up learning a lot about lots of things that you never thought you would learn about. The Iowa sausage producers were concerned that Koreans were not buying enough sausage from Iowa. And they wanted us to say, you must have some hidden barrier. Otherwise, you would be eating more of our sausages. And so they wanted us to put pressure on Korea to buy more sausages. one of the reasons why we wanted priorities is that in the previous Bush administration, one of their great achievements was, one of their great achievements was that they, after enormous pressure on Japan, they finally succeeded in getting Japan to allow a Toys R Us store to open up. And we said, yeah, this is a wonderful achievement. You have Toys R Us selling Chinese toys to Japanese children. And we know as Americans, we care a great deal about Chinese workers, and we care a great deal about Japanese children. And this is an important aspect of our international foreign policy. But we said, is this the most important part of our international policy, that we should be promoting the welfare, well-being of Japanese children and Chinese workers? So that was the same issue that we were bringing up here. Was Iowa sausage more important than? And Treasury's view was, no, it's not as important as making sure that American Wall Street firms could sell destabilizing derivatives to Korea. Now, Korea had a plan for liberalizing its capital markets, opening itself up to financial flows. That was a pattern over a period of 5 years. But we wanted it to happen very quickly. So we put enormous amount of pressure on them. And the result of it was that they did open up their markets to destabilizing capital flows. The Council of Economic Advisors had argued not only should that not be a priority for the U.S. government, it was probably a bad thing, because if capital, this speculative capital comes in for an economy that is not ready for it, not taking the time to prepare, your money will come in and go out, and that destabilization may wreak havoc on the economy. And unfortunately, we were right. They opened up their market beginning around 94, 95, and by 97, they had by end of 97, we had the East Asia financial crisis. And it was because of what we had done in forcing them to open up their capital markets to this destabilizing capital flows that was directly responsible. And they know it, and it's been, you know, one of the sources of tension. So the bottom line of all this is I've just given one example, is that we had this opportunity after the end of the Cold War to redefine the global economic order in terms of a set of principles and values, but we didn't do that. We let it be dictated by a set of special interests and a certain sex of ideology. Let me conclude by some remarks about what has happened in the last 4 years. A lot of people, when they read the book, thought I was very hard on my own, on the Clinton administration. And what I say is that, to my students, I say, I'm a tough grader. But at the end of the semester, each paper I grade them very tough, you know, and they get a little depressed, but I try to buoy their spirits. But I say at the end of the semester, I grade on a curve. And grading on the curve, I have to give Clinton an A+, compared to what came before and after. And what I want to do is just spend a few minutes trying to explain why I give such a low grade to what's come after. The economy now is in a rather fragile recovery. If I have more time, I'll talk about why I think it's so fragile. But what I want to first point out is to emphasize how bad the economy has done over the last 3-4 years. One way to focus on this is the gap between the economy's what the economy has actually performed and its potential. When you don't perform up to your potential, you're wasting resources. It's like throwing money away. People who could be working don't have jobs. And if you calculate how much our economy has lost in terms of dollars, it's almost surely in excess of $1 trillion that we've lost over the last 3.5 years. Even for a rich country, that's a lot of money that could have been used for a lot of good purposes that we lost because of the mismanagement. Another way, we have a lot of talk about the fiscal deficit, and I'll come to that in a minute, but the equally important is the jobs deficit. Every year somewhere between 1 million and 1.5 million workers entered the labor force. So just to keep up with the new entrants, the jobs for our college graduates, just to keep up with that, we need to create between 1 million and 1.5 million jobs a year. So we should have been creating something like 4 to 6 million jobs over the last 3.5 years. We actually lost over 1.5 million jobs. So we have a jobs deficit of something like 6-7 million jobs. That's a serious job deficit. And it will take a long time to make up for that job deficit, and there's enormous social cost of that. Now, one of the things that one hears all the time is the economy was going into recession when Bush became president. He wasn't so powerful that he could not create a recession that quickly. And the economy entered recession in March of 2001. But every president inherits a legacy of strengths and weaknesses. Clinton inherited an economy in recession, a huge fiscal deficit, a huge trade deficit, growing inequality. And he did some things about some of them and not about others. One of the things he did was he turned the 5% of GDP deficit into a 2% surplus. One of the advantages that Bush had when he took office was that there was this 2% surplus. That meant that there was money that he could have spent to stimulate the economy. And if he had spent it wisely to stimulate the economy, the economic downturn would have been short and shallow. But instead, he took a tax cut that was not designed to stimulate the economy and did very little, a little, but very little, to stimulate the economy. And that was why we've had such a long economic downturn. It was because of this deliberate to grow again. And the very people who were doing the best were given the biggest tax cut. Predictably, it didn't have, as I said, much effect on stimulating the economy. And that is why the economy did not recover very quickly. Now, but what it did do is lead to a huge deficit. And here I also fault Greenspan, because in May, in the spring of 2001, he supported this deficit, this tax cut. He said at the time he was worried that we would fully pay off our surplus, our debt, our national debt, that the surpluses were so large that eventually we would have no national debt, and that as Fed chairman he would find it difficult to conduct monetary policy without any national debt. Now, this threat was not quite imminent. And it was perfectly clear that if it were a threat that would become imminent, that is to say, 4 years, 6 years, 8 years later, our national debt had gotten very low, Congress is very able to get that debt back up very quickly. And so I don't understand why he had such lack of faith in Congress. Well, the real answer is that he had a very different agenda. His agenda was not a technocratic agenda. He really had an agenda that was political in nature, and in the question time we can get into it a little bit more. The result of this, though, of course, is that because we did not get as much fiscal stimulation as we should have gotten, we had to rely more on monetary policy. We had to rely more on lowering interest rates. And that worked because households took out bigger mortgages. But that means today household debt is much larger than it was before. And that means going forward, not only is the government's debt higher, but so is the household debt. So is our trade debt. The United States is borrowing more than $1.5 billion a day because we are living beyond our means as a country. So these are all some of the parameters that no matter who is elected in November, they will have to be dealt with. Finally, let me say that the problems in globalization that I highlighted have become far worse. The concerns about unilateralism, the concerns about a lack of values of America pursuing a global agenda that is totally in the, its own interest or in the interest of special interest is much stronger, more strongly believed. I just finished a trip around the world. The sense of alienation towards the United States has never been greater. The failure of Cancun, which was the trade negotiations, supposedly on development, to enact the development round that began in Doha in November 2001, broke down because our refusal to even begin to talk meaningful discussions to make this a development round, to pay attention to the concerns of the developing country. Well, let me just conclude by saying I think the period of the 90s and the last few years, to use a euphemism, is a fascinating period. It was a period that it was very dramatic. It was an exciting period. I think, and what I try to do in the book is to try to say there are a large number of lessons that can be learned from these experiences, the experiences both of the 90s and of the years that have followed. I think that we ignore these lessons at our peril. Thank you.
Nope, it's on. Okay. I'm pleased to tell you, as was indicated before, Dr. Steiglitz will answer questions. We have volunteers with microphones on each aisle, and I'd like you to raise your hand, and I'll call on you so that you can have a chance at the microphone and ask a question. Raise your hand high. There's a gentleman right here.
Thank you for your time tonight, Professor. You were very hard on the Treasury Department tonight, and three times, it seems to me, discussing the expenses of options, repeal of Glass-Steagall, and the Korea with the
capital market liberalization.
Sure.
Yeah.
I was curious why you didn't give us a name at Treasury. It seems to me it has to be it has to be Robert Rubin, doesn't it? Who else could it be?
Well, actually, there's more than him. Larry Summers as well. that's right.
Okay. I mean, I am.
What?
All right. Do you ever talk to Glenn Hubbard?
Yes.
You do?
Yeah.
All right. Glad to hear it. Thank you again for your time.
Okay. Please raise your hand. We'll have the gentleman right here with the black shirt.
Hi, Professor. What grade would you give Clinton if it wasn't on a curve?
Well, I don't know how you grade presidents. Let me say that I think they all have one of the things that one comes to understand when you at least I thought when I was at the Council of Economic Advisors in the White House is how limited power is. We have one of the advantages, particularly when there is a Congress that's in a different party than the president, is that there's a very strong check and balance. So you can't do as much as you would want. And you're very constrained. So I guess what I would say is that there were many things that were done well. And I the achievements of getting unemployment down to 3.8% was important, mostly the economy, but there were certain things that the administration did that helped. There were a number of policies that affected the overall performance of the economy, I think, that were positive. The ability to do a lot of other things was very constrained. And some of the things that I am also critical of, I've described some, I didn't get a chance to describe all the ones that I was critical of, and the next it was, for instance, the repeal of the capital gains, the cutting of the capital gains tax. I think that was, the timing couldn't have been worse, because just as the stock market bubble was going off, you cut the capital gains tax, and that made it even, increased the frenzy even more. The distribution consequences were very adverse. That was an interesting one because Rubin actually was not enthusiastic about the capital gains tax cut, but Summers was. So there was a division even within Treasury on that particular issue.
Okay, we'll have if you could catch the gentleman in the middle here, and then I want you to go all the way back on the right.
Oh, let me just give two examples of issues that where. I thought they did a better job than what's happened, and in areas that are actually quite interesting. One of them is in the area of agriculture. The Freedom of Farm Act that was passed in 1995 was designed to phase out reduced farm subsidies. And what happened more recently is they actually doubled the farm subsidies, and that has been one of the things that has gotten most antagonism, one of the sources of the failure of Cancun. Another example was the issue of steel tariffs to keep out, we talk about free market rhetoric. There was a lot of pressure to increase steel tariffs, and they resisted that pressure to increase steel tariffs. And then the Bush administration gave in to that pressure and then was ruled to be a violation of international law, and they had to repeal them. So those are a couple examples where both when you see it on the curve and you see absolutely, they did some right things.
Right here.
Dr. Stieglitz, how do you factor in what's going on in the housing market today where you have so many people who have tremendous mortgages and are buying a house at far greater, in a range that's way above their income? I think Richard Russell said, and look at the housing prices in California and the number of families that actually have incomes above $100,000 a year, and you ask yourself, what might happen here?
Yeah, this is one of the sources of when I said I view the economy to be in a precarious position. What I worry about is if interest rates rise, which they have done whenever the economy recovers. I mean, the interest rates are at an all-time low. So the likelihood of an increase of interest rates, maybe not next year, but certainly in the not too distant future, seems very large. If interest rates rise, it will put pressure both directly on households, but indirectly, new people buying new houses, will find that they will. When they ask the question, what kind of a mortgage can I afford, they'll say, I can afford a much smaller mortgage. That will put a dampener on housing prices. So there's a real risk, I think, of certainly the rate of increase of housing prices will be diminished. And a lot of the buying of housing is based on that speculation. But actually, the risk even that the housing prices could fall. If that happens, it could be a real damper on the economy. There's studies that seem to show that the sensitivity of consumption to housing prices is much larger than the stock prices.
Okay, in the back, and then we'll come down.
Professor, thank you for your very good insights here, especially one of the things I think is very important is the continuing unwillingness of the haves of the world to share with the have-nots, and also the post-Cold War change that I think a lot of people don't fundamentally get that here in this country. But I wonder if some of the conclusions I draw a couple of different conclusions from your same points here. One, and maybe I'm misreading it, but one is that I read a lot of that as government failure as opposed to market failure, as you've described there, and government failure leading to what I think set up numbers which are kind of bogus, 1999 and 2000, the revenues of the federal government that led to those surpluses, the employment numbers that we saw, I think were basically phony numbers. And so the reductions from them is in a sense phony. Second, this crowd probably will lead more towards one party than another, but I think that if I watch the campaign commercials right now for both parties, both candidates and both parties tend to do exactly what I think and tend to cater to and pander to the exact behavior that you describe as being sort of bad in a sense, us first and at all costs there. And then third, I wonder if the prescription for the world out in the world, this somebody might get a message that that okay, you should keep more government and less free markets there, and in fact that the having free markets in the rest of the world might get some of these might allow some of these countries to produce and actually come up and slug it out with the United States. And I also just know not only the United States but Europe and some of the others. I think you're letting our European friends and other first world countries off the hook a little bit in terms of being not willing to be, share with the haves, the have-nots, I mean. Thank you.
Okay. Those are three big questions. Let me try to answer. First, accounting problems are problems both in the public and private sector. I agree. The numbers on the deficit, though, the problem wasn't that the numbers were distorted. They were those were fairly accurate numbers. The real question are the projections. Projections are, by their nature, unreliable. And what was so, for me, disappointing, anybody who's been the chairman of the Council of Economics or in this business knows how unreliable they are. You know, it's difficult to predict 1 or 2 years, but 10 years ahead is really difficult. Or, I mean, it's just a guess. And Greenspan had been chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. He surely knew that. And that's why trying to spend the money before you get it was particularly, I think, objectionable. There were some very good reasons, though, why even at that point one should have recognized the mistakes in the way that the projections were made or the limitations in the projections. One of the reasons the tax revenue was so large was there were a lot of capital gains and a lot of capital gains taxes from those capital gains. But once the market started going down, you were having capital losses. You don't get capital gains revenues when the market is crashing. And that was pretty clear that that was going to be a problem, at least a reasonably clear, and they should have taken that into account. So I agree with you. There was clearly a real problem of government failure of not doing their economics well, but it was avoidable. People were pointing this out, and they just didn't pay any attention. The second point, I think there's a fundamental problem in that economic globalization has outpaced what I might call political and moral globalization. We have this integrated world where transportation costs have come down, communication costs have come down, barriers to trade have come down. We are much more integrated, but we don't have a political mechanism for dealing with that kind of interdependence. With more integration comes more interdependence, but we don't really have an effective way of addressing some of the problems that are created by interdependence. And a very related phenomena is that the market economy works partly because we recognize that there are failures, limits. After the problems of the corporate scandals, we passed the Sarbanes-Oxley, not a complete fix, but at least a move in the right direction. So we recognize that markets by themselves do not always work. We need to have some rules. Okay. We also recognize that markets don't produce social may not produce an acceptable distribution of income. So we temper market processes with a certain sense of social justice. But unfortunately, our notions of social justice stop at the border, or at least diminish greatly at the border. We worry a great deal about poor within our country, but our policies that impoverish somebody in Mexico, we don't worry about. The fact our corn subsidies lower the price of corn, and so the poorest people in Mexico who grow corn are becoming worse off, we never talk about that. Our rich corn farmers are getting better off. That's what makes us happy. So that's the kind of thing where in our public discourse, we don't really think about the impact that we have beyond our border and this notion that in the difference, and I mentioned that in my talk, when we talk about economic policy and we conduct economic policy in the United States, it's always the language we use is always what's in the best interest of the country. Nobody ever comes forward and says, I want this because it's going to make me more money. all policy reform is defended as everybody is going to benefit from this. It's always in the general interest. Nobody is selfish inside the country. But when it comes to international economic policy, we never use that language. It's always, it's good for the United States, therefore we should do it. We never ask what would be good for the global society. It's just not a part of our framework of talking about it. And the political processes have the same failure. When we make decisions inside our country, at least in principle, we have everybody at the table. Treasury, Council of Economic Advisors, Justice, Commerce, Trade, Environment. They're all sitting there and debating. Some voices are heard more loudly, but they're all there. Internationally, we have a very much of a chimney structure. The trade ministers discuss trade regulations, but don't pay any attention to environment or labor or any other thing. And similarly in international financial institutions.
Okay. Okay, we have a question here. And we had a woman over here because I want to get somebody female. We have right here. Okay, that'll be next. Okay, first here.
You covered issues, I think, talking about economics, sort of social policy and politics and how they all interact. I think, my question is on that dimension, what are your views about the current debate or ongoing debate about outsourcing of American jobs into foreign countries, India, other places like that, especially white collar and maybe now more higher value content jobs?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was in India in January, went to Bangalore, went to one of the places where things are outsourced to Infosys. It's a $7 billion company. They call them campuses. And it was a more modern campus than anything I've seen in Silicon Valley, and just very, very impressive. I spent some time talking to the head of it and you know, really understood how to interact in a global economy. So one of the things that is clearly happening is, you know, that globalization has clearly meant that entrepreneurship has become globalized. The head of this spent, I don't know, 10 years or more in Silicon Valley learning all these ideas and then went back to India and is using them to successfully develop a truly global company. There are two views on this, and it's a subject of an enormous amount of controversy. One of them is that outsourcing is great for the economy. It's just like any other technological innovation. It lowers costs, therefore increases profits, and what increases profits is good for the economy. It's just saving costs. Now, that would be true if our economy were being well managed. After NAFTA was signed, I don't know if you remember Ross Perot talking about the giant sucking sound, we were going to lose an enormous number of jobs. Well, after NAFTA was passed, unemployment in the United States fell to 3.8% across a wide range of jobs. I mean, we created all kinds of jobs. So when the economy is working well, you don't worry about these issues because you can create new jobs as old jobs get lost. But when the economy is not functioning well, and it's not been functioning well for the last 3.5 years, that's what I talk about, the job deficit, then, of course, when you are losing jobs, you're not creating new jobs. Your problem is that you're moving people from, you know, the general theory of trade is that you're supposed to move people from low productivity jobs to high productivity jobs. But if you move them from low productivity jobs to unemployment, the economy is weaker. And that's what we're doing now because the economy is not being well managed. So that is the underlying a lot of the discontent with outsourcing. But beyond that, there's one other problem that I think is going to be with us for a very long time. And that is that that outsourcing can affect the demand for jobs of particular kinds. And in the longer run, wages are set by the laws of demand and supply. And if the demand for labor goes down, if there's competition, if you can only hire workers because they're competing with workers who are paid half or a quarter, or a tenth of what ours, then it will put enormous pressure on wages. You know, the story, at least the numbers that you hear bandied around, is that the Indian tech workers are paid about a tenth of American, and they may be half as productive, but that still gives them an enormous cost advantage. So if that's true, the United States may wind up becoming a rich country with poor people. That we should remember that during the 70s, from 73 to 93, while the economy grew, incomes of the people at the bottom third actually declined, the real incomes. So trickle-down economics does not always work. The economy can get richer, and a lot of people can get poorer. And I think that is the worry about that. To me, that is the real worry about outsourcing. Final two remarks. One is John Kenneth Galbraith recently celebrated his 95th birthday, and there was a story I've heard. I don't know whether it's true, but at least that's two stories I heard about on the occasion of his birthday. He made two remarks. One of them was that he never believed that he would live to see the day that he wished Reagan were president. And the other one was Galbraith had been ambassador to India, and he said he never believed that he would live to see the day that Americans were worried about competition from India at the white collar worker. Now, the final remark is that. What is particularly disturbing about the white collar worker, the programmers going offshore, is that what we always said was when NAFTA came in, we said, "Don't worry about it. We want to lose those low skilled jobs. We want to lose those jobs in textiles. What we want is the high skilled jobs. We're gonna strengthen our education system." That was the hope. And we will have educated people, and they will be able to outcompete anywhere else. And what we now see is that answer was perhaps a little too facile, because the people who are losing their jobs are well-educated people, and we can't expect much more education than that. And so we are going to have to think a little bit more about what are the strategies, how to respond.
Ladies and gentlemen, there are many more questions. I did ask one person. That's right. I did promise you. Go right ahead.
I wanted to know what you thought about the cost of the war in Iraq. What do you project for the future, and what will it do to us? And then the second part of that, which is related, is oil. Could you give us your opinions on what's going to happen, both with the cost of oil and with our dependence on certain countries for oil?
Yeah. Let me answer the second question first, because in some ways it's easier. I think I've been long concerned about our dependence on oil, I think and the answer is not extracting more oil from the North Slope of Alaska, or the policy that many people in this administration advocate, which is I call drain America first. You take all the oil out, and in the future we will be even more dependent on foreigners. It makes absolutely no sense. There's only one solution, which is to become to use less oil, less energy. And that's why the focus has to be on conservation policies. And as an economist, there is one way that you encourage conservation. It's the price system. And it works all over the world. It is not an accident that we are the most gas-guzzling country in the world, because we have the lowest taxes on gas. People live in Europe very happy lives with much lower energy consumption. And we could have just a high GDP, just a high standard of living, with a much lower utilization of energy, including oil. So that, I think, is in a way an easy answer. What we should be doing. I think that there is a real risk of high oil prices going forward if we don't do that. The other question of, well, the forecast for Iraq, the first observation I want to make is that it's very clear that we were not presented with accurate estimates. And the... I know that was an understatement, but... But I'm an academic. I'm supposed to say these things in an understated way. The one person who gave an estimate that was anywhere near in the ballpark was Bush's advisor, Larry Lindsey, and he was fired for doing that. So I think that what is clear is I think that it was foreseeable that the cost would be very high. The second issue has to do with one of the naiveties in the discussion prior to the war was that they said, "Oh, Iraq has all this oil; it won't cost us. They can finance their own restructuring." But that forgot the fact that Iraq is very deeply in debt. And also has trouble getting the oil out. but even apart from that, it's deeply in debt. Well, the United States, I've talked to senior people in the U.S. administration, and their view is U.S. made a contribution by bombing Iraq. The others can make a contribution by forgiving the debt. their argument is that since very little of the debt is owed to the United States, it's clear that Germany and Russia should forgive the debt. They don't quite see it as enthusiastically as we do on that. But it's actually causing a lot of problems around the world. I was in Nigeria about 2 weeks ago, and Nigeria has a much smaller debt of about $30 billion, but their view is, why is Iraq more deserving of debt relief than we are? Iraq's per capita income is 2 to 3 times that of Nigeria. Nigeria, too, suffered from a terrible dictator, a military dictator, that robbed their country, that took out, they over the last 20 years, have had some $250 billion, and after 20 years, their per capita income is half of what it was. It's down now to around $360 per capita. That's a little over a dollar a day. It's not a very high standard of living. And they ask, why is Iraq more deserving of debt relief than they are? I think that's a good question. And all over Africa and other countries, they're saying, shouldn't there be some general principles of debt relief? Shouldn't there be an international law of debt relief? Besides the principle that when it's owed money to the United States, we don't give relief, and when it's owed to other countries, we argue for it. They're looking for some other principle beyond that. I think this is a subject of enormous concern, but I do think that unless debt relief is given, it will be very difficult for Iraq to recover. And it's important to remember what happened after World War I, where there's a very, very powerful book that Keynes wrote called The Economic Consequences of the Peace, where he pointed out the debt burden that was placed on Germany had a very high probability of leading to chaos, social disorder that would have very adverse effects in the future, which he was right. So that's part of the issue of the uncertainty about how much it will cost us is knowing how much others will engage in debt forgiveness. The third issue is that the United States laid out a strategy for restructuring that was almost doomed to failure. And the only reason why things are not as bad as one would have forecast is that it's not been implemented. Last September, we announced a strategy which was announced a strategy which is sometimes called shock therapy. Immediate liberalization, privatization of everything in the society. Okay, that kind of shock therapy was what was tried in Russia and led Russia's GDP to fall by about 30 to 40%. Now, Iraq is starting with about a 50% unemployment rate. And if Iraq's GDP falls that amount, things will really get very bad. But there's every reason to believe that if we implement that shock therapy, things will be very bad. So, but as I say, the good thing is that they haven't done it. And I think as a new government comes in, it's very likely that it will not happen. I think that there's no way of actually coming up with a number of what the cost will be until security gets established. I don't know if you just saw that the Russians who were involved in trying to repair the electricity have just pulled out. So, you know, what does it mean? At what price will people go into an unsecure environment to provide some of the basic services? It can be clearly phenomenal. And clearly, if it costs the United States, if we started providing some of the things that we ought to be providing, both for our soldiers in terms of little things like better armor, but also to help finance the restructuring that should have been done a year ago, clearly the cost can be much larger than anybody's been talking about.
Please join us upstairs, buy a book, get your book signed, and have a chance to ask Dr. Steiglitz some questions one-on-one. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.